So you can see the world's animals in a zoo. But one thing you may never see is the fabric of history and myth that humans have woven around them. For example, in Sicily, the legacy of the bluefin tuna sounds like this. Italian fishermen singing a song of the bluefin catch. When Teresa Maggio went to Favignana, an island off the coast of Sicily, she discovered the world of the Matanza. It's the name for the ancient ritual of bluefin tuna fishing, using a series of nets. She told Steve Paulson about her first Matanza.
What we saw were 40 fishermen lined up on the edge of a 75-foot-long boat who began to sing and pull up a net from the bottom of the sea. It actually hangs like a cup or a hammock, and the deepest part reaches the seafloor, which is 100 feet deep at that point. And they began to sing this dirge-like song. I couldn't understand the words. I didn't really hear them well because the wind was whipping their voices away. But as they pulled this net up, their boat got closer to ours, and this square became a rectangle and got smaller and smaller. And as they pulled, the sea turned from a deep navy blue to lapis lazuli to turquoise as this white net that they pulled up came up. And in it, we saw these huge black shapes looming beneath the surface. Then the shapes came to the surface and dorsal fins started cutting crazy lines in the smooth seawater. Then they started thrashing when they found that they couldn't escape. Thrashing so hard that the columns of water went 10 feet high above our heads, and it sounded like standing at the bottom of a huge waterfall. People were screaming. They got soaked. No one had any idea, certainly not me, of what they were about to see. And then when the thrashing died down, one man who was in a boat with his boat captain in the center of this maelstrom blew a whistle and gave the command to start the killing. And the men on this boat opposite us, 40 of them, leaned over the side of their boat with gaffs of varying lengths, barbed gaffs, and snagged a tuna. And once they got a tuna close to them, they formed up teams, five teams of eight men each, eight men to a tuna, four on either side.
And it's worth pointing out that these tuna are huge fish.
Yes, the ones that I saw in 1986, many of them were well over 1,000 pounds, the size of a cow or a horse or a Volkswagen. Thrashing, a machine made to live in the sea and migrate thousands of miles, 100 miles a day. Really, it's a big muscle with eyes. The giant bluefin, gorgeous fish, silvery blue with violet dapplings on its side and canary yellow, triangular dorsal fins. Beautiful fish. Eight men would snag a fish, and the two men in the middle, who had to be the strongest members of the team, have the shortest gaffs because they have to do the brunt of the lifting. And the men on either side of them, fanning out on either side of them, had longer and longer gaffs so that when they're hooked into a fish, it looked like a chevron pointed down into the sea, like a sergeant's stripes. And then it sometimes takes 10, 15 minutes to get one of these giant tuna fish into position with its head out of the water and lined up against the side of the boat. And when they were ready, they would yell, uno, e due, one and two. And they'd heave up on two and heave it up to the gunwale.
It sounds just incredibly dramatic. I mean, I can only imagine what the sight would be. It also sounds, frankly, pretty brutal.
It is, and they admit it. It's a cruel but beautiful thing. I say beautiful, but I probably wouldn't say it if I were a bluefin.
What makes it beautiful?
Well, for one, the colors. The red blood. These are warm-blooded fish. I didn't know that they existed until I started to write this book, Warm-Blooded Fish. They bleed red blood. Their colors change as they die. They go from this silvery gray blue. Sometimes they turn copper-colored or gold-colored. They sort of shimmer. Incandescent. Plus the undercurrent of thousands of years of history that now I know has gone on before them. And having this mountain behind you, a 1,000-foot mountain with a 1,000-year-old and an 1,100-year-old castle on top of it, built by Ruggero, who was a Norman king that came through. He became king of Sicily, who built it to protect his Tonara. When he came to Sicily, he made all the Tonaras. A Tonara is a tuna station, not just the trap, but the whole, the crew of men, all the equipment, all the boats, all the cannery, the boathouse, the net house, all together. It's called a Tonara.
How would you describe the relationship that the fishermen have with their prey, with these tuna who give them their livelihoods?
They wait for them in a way like lovers. Every spring, it's what starts the year. While they're setting up their trap, they're filled with hope. They know that these, what used to be thousands of tuna fish, were swimming toward them, mating and dodging sharks, which are one of their few predators, and coming towards their island, and their trap is ready. The trap actually consists of two parts. It's barrier nets set up across the migration path of the bluefin tuna who swim into the Mediterranean to spawn. And these barrier nets, which go from sea surface to sea floor, funnel them into the mouth of this trap.
This must be just an enormous net. And the way you write about it, there are actually compartments in the net so that the fishermen can channel the tuna from one part of the net to the next.
Right. You can picture it as an open shoebox going from the sea floor to the sea surface. And this rectangular shoebox is divided into 7 rooms. It's actually into 8 now. They made an innovation. 7 rooms. And each room has a door in the dividing wall between one room and the next. And what the fishermen do is the barrier nets funnel the tuna into the entrance, which is topped by a 10-foot-tall crucifix, which has gladiolas atop it, which were on the steps of the altar at church on Easter, and pictures of 10 or 12 saints. They swim under this crucifix into the trap, into what's called the Camera Grande, the great room. And then every day, twice a day, the fishermen go out and shoo the fish closer and closer to the chamber of death, which is the last room.
What happens to the tuna after they're caught, after they're killed? Are they sold elsewhere?
Yes, for most of the time that I was researching this book, the tuna, once caught, were iced down on this motorless boat. You could call it a barge. It was a flat-bottom boat that got towed to Trapani, where they were slaughtered and butchered, and sold to the Japanese.
Hmm. I was amazed to read how much these tuna can go for in a Tokyo sushi bar, at some of the high-end sushi bars. What, $75 for two bites? That's phenomenal.
Yes, but that's mostly Japanese businessmen taking their corporate credit card to treat a guest or a possible client. It was to impress clients, because the fatty belly meat of the tuna to them is what caviar is to us. It's a prestige food.
So really what you're describing is rituals all around. There's this elaborate ritual of catching the fish, and then the way the Japanese eat them on the other side of the world, that's full of ritual as well.
That is true. It's funny how rituals seem to flow around these bluefin tuna, almost as if the bluefin created or demand some sort of reverence for their flesh.
Teresa Maggio talked with Steve Paulson about her book, Matanza.